I started to say that military lore, tradition has it, that when you're chasing an army that's in retreat, you don't just stop and because there's an imaginary line somewhere. You pursue it to destruction if you can. Or otherwise it mobilizes and comes back at you. I mean, that's just the that's just the common sense of military tradition. But in this case, you had, it seemed to me then, I think still does, you had a conflict, in a sense, between the political and the military realities. It was foreseeable that a problem would arise with respect to that very point if the Korean forces, if and when the Korean forces themselves retreated north of the 38th parallel in flight and for reordering their ranks or whatever. So from the military point of view, the 38th parallel was purely a juridical concept and really had no military relevance. That was the impression I had. I mean, it seemed, and I believe that that entered into our minds. I mean, certainly some of us who were discussing the resolution of October 7th, the ambiguity was, as I say, a calculated one, with the expectation that that would be that the reality, the military realities, would dictate the events.
Now there was another, if I could interrupt, another aspect of it.
So I said to him one day, that I really, now that the UN, the Congress has passed, has amended the UN Participation Act, created the job of deputy U.S. representative with across the board authority, which hadn't existed up to that point, to exercise all the authority, including voting in the Security Council, etc., that the ambassador, the permanent representative had, with the rank of ambassador and all that. So I said, I really would like to go up there. I've always been interested in the UN, just as I was interested in the League of Nations before that. This went to us, Sue used to attend sessions of the League as a student in Geneva. He looked at me with an utter astonishment that I would want to do that. He couldn't understand. He said, you know, I think you're doing a very, very good job here. You've just very skillfully steered the North Atlantic Treaty through the Senate, and eternally grateful, and so making, you know, a real flowery speech. And he said, really? Do you think you want to do that? I said, yes, I really would, Mr. Secretary. He shook his head as if about to say, you know, about you should consult a psychiatrist if that's what you really want to do. He was really not very, he felt that there wouldn't be anything happening up there. Let me tell you a story.
Let me check something, just one.
That was the political, if you like, lubrication for the military action. But to proscribe any movement, the military movement north of the 38th parallel, was a different question. That was a military question. The other was the ultimate political objective. And the ceasefire group got hung up on that. We have to get to that pretty soon because it's relevant. When was that? We received at the mission a telegram. This would happen to be top secret. On December 20th, 1950. I'd like to read a portion of it.
Sure.
It was really an instruction to us, which meant under the circumstances as I was handling the thing to me. In view of the this was in December 20th, after the Chinese intervention, so it's not directly responsive to your question, except that it was a consequence.
Right.
Of that interpretation of the October 7th resolution and the military realities as they were perceived in the theater. In view of the undeniably heightened danger of general war, this was the Secretary's message to me, we should overlook no honorable possibility of bringing about a peaceful settlement in Korea. We believe it therefore wise not to become overly entangled in the procedural maze into which our ceasefire and other proposals have developed, to take stock of our basic purposes. You know, this is Achesonian approach. Yeah. To me, I've actually, as it happened, the reason for UN action in Korea was to may I read this?
Certainly.
Was to repel North Korean aggression against the Republic of China. There has now been added the aggression of China. If the free world is to survive, we cannot voluntarily permit aggression to be rewarded. On this point, we will not compromise or bargain. Two, our objective in Korea, and this is our objective in Korea has never varied from that of the UN resolutions, the establishment of a unified, independent, and democratic country. We had hoped and still hope to bring that about by peaceful means under United Nations procedures. Neither we nor the United Nations were committed to bring it about by whatever force would be required. The enemy is now, in fact, capable of preventing a UN military success in all of Korea. Three, we have consistently desired and still desire the earliest possible withdrawal of United Nations forces from Korea. This must, as a minimum, be accompanied by a cessation of North Korean attacks across the 38th parallel and withdrawal of Chinese forces. It is our earnest desire that the ETASAM group, that was a ceasefire group that I was daily constant touch with, will be successful in arranging a ceasefire which could lead to a generally acceptable peaceable settlement for Korea, including acceptance by Korea's neighbors. To this end, we are willing to discuss the matter in a forum or procedure which would include the Chinese communists. Despite undoubted basic differences in ultimate purposes, there may at least be room for discussion leading to modus vivendi if they desire, as they have stated, a cessation of hostilities and a withdrawal of foreign forces from Korea. Then some accommodation might be possible and we should be able to discuss a peaceful settlement. This holding of such discussions should not depend upon prior commitments from either side as to positions to be taken in discussions. A discussion itself does not constitute agreement, appeasement. Therefore, if our friends in the UN, including ETASAM, Pearson, and Rao, ETASAM was the Iranian,
right.
Pearson, Canadian, and Rao, the Indian, the three of them composing the ceasefire group. If our friends in the UN, including those three, and the Chinese communists, understand our basic willingness to talk and use peaceful methods, they may be able to work out a situation to bring this about. We have immediately in mind a cessation of hostilities with the military situation stabilized at the 38th parallel. We believe an effort to achieve this prior to any communist offensive across the parallel is of great importance. We suggest that you use the foregoing as a basis for discussions with Rao, ETASAM, and Pearson.
That then brings us right to the question of your relations with the
ceasefire group,
with the ceasefire committee, because already in December they did propose, I believe, a ceasefire. Establishment of a demilitarized zone with the 38th parallel as the southern border.
That's right.
Which is rather close to what the secretary
Very close, yeah, because I immediately began discussions.
Could you explain how that was done?
The
discussions, right. How did the discussions take place? Did you use these instructions as a basis for the discussion?
Oh, yes, indeed. I reported back. Wanted to spend that for a moment. This did not go into your record.
Yes, that did.
That did.
That did, but not just what you've read now.
No, I didn't want you didn't want that.
No.
But this did. Okay.
That did. Yes. Mm-hmm. Now, if we could just continue on this, the U.S. side then had confidence in the activities of the ceasefire committee, the three-man ceasefire committee. You had confidence in what they were trying to do.
We had confidence in the individuals,
right.
As individuals. Speaking for myself, I don't think we had much confidence they're going to get very far.
Right.
Given the fact that the Chinese were not paying any attention to their approaches.
But the effort to achieve a ceasefire at this point was in accordance with U.S. objectives.
This was, yes. this is a December 20th message from the department,
right,
or instruction, if you like, was the last waltz with the ceasefire committee, as it turned out.
Right.
Because by within, what was it, I would say 2 weeks, less than 2 weeks, about 2 weeks, we reported that the ceasefire initiatives had failed.
Right. And
so then we started to look for different formulas, but without success.
And at this point, did the position of the British and others on recognition of the People's Republic of China have a major influence on the prospects of resolution drafting?
And you mean in terms of results?
Right.
No. Actually, Jeb said, and my recollection is sort of repeats in his memoirs, that although they felt that he said this to me a number of times personally, that although they felt that we were making a terrible mistake in opposing the seating of Communist China in the UN, that the British they felt that we would gain more than we would lose by having that contact with him, direct contact with him. But he said at the same time that although the British had been quick to recognize the Chinese Communist government, that, to put it, they had not been recognized back, that they had never had more than higher than a chargé d'affaires, that the Chinese would never exchange ambassadors with them. So that they were sending a signal to the British that, in effect, that they couldn't normalize relations with the closest ally of the U.S. while the U.S. was opposing their admission to the Security Council, and the British were apparently supporting the U.S. position, which was inconsistent with the U.K. recognition of Communist China. So Jeb was on the losing side of the poker game there, I thought.
Now, from the telegram that you read from the department in this period, it's clear that the United States was not totally opposed to the participation of the People's Republic of China in some form of...
You see, we were playing the same confused game. We didn't want them in the UN for political reasons. At the same time, as the message said, we talk with them anytime,
right,
any place. Well, you know, when you say any forum, I interpret that being in the UN. If you're not qualified, I don't know if the drafting of this cable realized that implication.
Right.
Of course, this is a top secret message.
And it was just at this point, I believe, that the Chinese General Wu did, in fact, arrive in New York. More or less, perhaps a little later.
Well, to make a speech. You know.
To make a speech, but there was no contact with him.
No. Trigger Lee tried to arrange it. I was in constant touch with Lee on that. But no, they weren't interested in contact.
But you would have been felt authorized to have contact with him.
I told Lee a number of times that if he could arrange it, that was the expected, we hoped. You know. We thought at first that might have been the reason for Wu's coming. The joke at that, and Rao was also pressing. The joke at that time was that Rao, who was the Indian representative, that Rao wooed and Wu rowed. That was the joke. You probably heard it.
No. Now, there were a number of more or less private initiatives in addition to the work of the ceasefire committee. On the part of the Indians.
Ceasefire group, they call it.
Or the ceasefire group.
Right.
I believe the Indians, perhaps the British, I don't know, I was going to ask you this. Were you aware during this period of efforts on the part of individual countries to arrange some kind of an ending to the war?
India was very actively engaged. The Panikkar was the... as you know, was the Indian ambassador to the UN, and Rao very frequently told us about the about Panikkar's messages to Nehru. Panikkar was firmly convinced, he always reported to Nehru. Rao was very frank with us about this, and very open and a wonderful fellow in terms of honesty of purpose and modesty, but strong will just the same. That Panikkar considered the Chinese government to be not a typical communist regime. Rao at one point said in a conversation which I reported to the department so they could get the feel of the Rao Panikkar Nehru thing. Mm-hmm. I have it in one of these messages, my message to the department, that Panikkar felt that we misjudged the Chinese communist government, that their policies were not like Stalin. They were not Stalinist. He didn't think that there was a monolithic kind of a rapport between Russia and China. And that we were making a mistake in not having some kind of rapport or at least a contact. Now that I think of it, it's a bit like President Bush and his attitude toward keeping contact with there was no contact. Except through the ceasefire group. As far as I'm aware, I never heard of any contact. Panikkar's influence with Nehru, exerted through Nehru, was that we should really be more open and not continue to obdurately to block it. I told Rao one day that actually that my instructions when I came up to the UN was that we were to balance what was called a knife edge neutrality with respect to the question of admission of China. We were not going to veto, we would not veto, if a majority of the Chinese, of the Security Council recommended, voted for admission. We were careful in discussions not to twist their arms. Although in public, the public declamations and rhetoric was always, over our dead bodies. But there was a tremendous difference between the gap between the declaratory policy, the rhetoric, and the knife-edge neutrality. When I came as a surprise to many of my friends and colleagues when I told them about that. That would have come about, this is a little off the point, but that would have come about the majority, but for France, because the French began to be, as I understood, Chauvel, worried about Chinese intervention and troublemaking in Indochina, and that colonial policy was getting in the way of objectivity on the part of the French, and the French, at one point, were the swing vote. We would have, we would not have vetoed.
And that would have been a recommendation for the People's Republic.
That would have been a vote to admit them. Is that all extraneous to you?
No, that's very, very relevant indeed. And it's just, I'd like to pursue it a little bit because I have read, I believe, in the Acheson memoirs or the Truman memoirs, that as the war proceeded, that Secretary Acheson took the position that the United States would not, under any circumstances, concur in the seating of the People's Republic because this would be rewarding the aggressor.
Oh, sorry.
That's okay.
I beg your pardon.
That's okay.
I was trying to get this out of
right. That's so fine. Was that reflected then later in telegrams? Because
as I say that I don't want to say that my old distinguished friend and boss Acheson was making one kind of speech and doing something else behind the curtain. Not at all, but I think he probably felt that. I doubt he felt the way he spoke. But I would like to just read you again this message on December 20th, the key sentence. It is our earnest desire that the ceasefire group will be able to arrange acceptable peaceful settlement. To this end, we are willing to discuss the matter.
It's okay, we've got some more time.
To this end, we are willing to discuss the matter in a forum or procedure which would include the Chinese Communists.
Right.
Well, I mean, the forum was obviously had to be the UN. But, I mean, from the standpoint of logic, with the ceasefire group, it's the UN group.
Yeah. That puts a new dimension on it. I had not heard of the role of France, for example, at this point.
Yeah, that's what I was told by Chauvel. Mm-hmm.